From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for El Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington Columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. 47 Republican senators sent an open letter to Iran, warning its supreme leader that the next U.S. president could revoke any nuclear deal signed by the Obama administration unless Congress first approves it. Iraq reported major progress in an offensive to retake Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, an operation in which Iran played a major role, but the United States did not. Israelis are preparing to vote in pivotal elections that could end the rule of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and usher in a center-left government less at odds with the United States over issues including Iran and Arab-Israeli peace talks. And finally, in the United States, presumptive presidential candidate Hillary Clinton held a news conference to answer questions about her use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State. Well, let's begin with the letter written by Tom Cotton and signed by 46 other Republican senators to the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. What were they thinking in telling a foreign leader that the president of the United States possibly didn't have the authority to sign an agreement on Iran's nuclear program?
Well, there's been a sort of three-pronged reaction here in Washington, and I think some of it has not been the reaction that history will remember. So there's been an initial, is this good for the Republicans, bad for the Republicans? And that I don't think is that interesting. There's also been a kind of fight about, was this somehow, illegal? Are they guilty of treason? Is this, within the Constitution? That as well is not that interesting. I think the really interesting question is, when these Republican senators wrote this open letter to Iran's leaders, were they really advancing America's national interest, which is what they claim to do? And I think that that's the real problem, is that they weren't advancing America's national interest. I mean, we need to be clear why they did this. They did this, in the words of Tom Cotton, the brand new senator who's been a senator for 2 months, who organized this effort, because he fundamentally doesn't believe that the negotiations taking place have any value, that they can lead to anything good. I think a very clarifying moment came when Tom Cotton, Senator Cotton of Arkansas, was being interviewed about the letter, and someone said, well, what do you make of the criticism from President Obama that by writing this letter, you have made common cause with the hardliners in Iran? And Tom Cotton's reply was, there are only hardliners in Iran.
Yeah.
So I think that was a very clarifying moment. What he was essentially saying is that the entire premise of these international talks, that there are more moderate figures, that Iran is capable of acting rationally, that you can increase the cost of an Iranian nuclear program to the point that Iran will choose a different path as a kind of rational act, he doesn't believe that. He essentially sides with people like Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, who came and told Congress at the invitation of Republicans a few days ago that essentially this is an apocalyptic death cult in charge of Iran, that they are not rational actors, and above all, that they are not trustworthy. And in essence, rather than trying to negotiate a solution to their desire to have an Iranian nuclear arsenal, you need to defeat them. You need to come up with coercion so massive that you can impose surrender on Iran, that you can impose terms on Iran. There is no point trying to negotiate terms with Iran. It has to be imposed, yeah. Otherwise it means nothing. And I think that Senator Cotton believes that. And everything he has said since is that he ignores criticism that says you're going to damage these negotiations. He says, good.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the point.
Yeah.
These
well,
negotiations,
yeah.
this track of seeking a negotiated settlement which involves Iran accepting a deal, is not worth going down, because deal they could accept isn't worth having.
In fact, even earlier he told the Heritage Foundation in January that the end of these negotiations isn't an unintended consequence of congressional action. It is very much an intended consequence. So he has said and made it clear from the beginning that he wants to blow up the negotiations. He doesn't want the negotiations to succeed. So it's not about a better deal. It's about no deal, as far as Tom Cotton is concerned. But I think there's another aspect, and you mentioned Benjamin Netanyahu, and that is the partisan nature of this opposition to the Iran negotiations. In the past, Congress has managed to make sanctions against Iran, policy on Iran, fairly bipartisan. There have always been Democrats who have supported these measures, sometimes in overwhelming numbers. But when you see this letter that's been signed by 47 Republicans only, in fact, it wasn't even shown to the Democrats. You do have partisanship very much entering the issue here. And a number of commentators, a number of editorialists in the United States have said this is very, very dangerous, not just for American foreign policy, but for American politics.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's also revealing. Let's not forget, 47 Republican senators signed this letter. Now, some of them, like Senator John McCain, former presidential candidate, are sort of saying, well, maybe I didn't sort of really read it properly when
Then he said he did.
And signed it in a bit of a haste. Maybe it wasn't the most effective way of doing it. But here's an important detail. There were 7 Republican senators who didn't sign it. Mm-hmm. Now, some of those are essentially moderates from very centrist states. But there's an important person who didn't sign this. Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, very important man in Washington, the new chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. He did not sign this letter. Now, he's not a squish on Iran. He's also not someone who particularly trusts President Obama to do a fantastic deal with Iran. He has expressed grave concerns that, in his view, President Obama is too willing to take any deal at any price. So he's absolutely a Republican on this. But why did Senator Corker, the chairman of the committee, not sign this letter? It's because he has a different approach to trying to achieve a good deal. His approach is to get a bipartisan, as you say, involving both Republicans and Democrats, to get a law passed which would require President Obama, after an initial deal is unveiled, to submit it to Congress and to suspend all of its kind of sanctions-lifting activity for 60 days and let Congress have a say. Now, that is a valuable exercise, absolutely in the American constitutional tradition. The Congress would have a sort of review
and
oversight.
Except this is not a treaty. It's not a treaty.
But you can argue about the details. But I think the idea of Congress saying, you know, the president goes off with his administration and negotiates the deal, but then once the deal has been negotiated, instead of immediately putting all of its parts into action, let Congress have at least a say. Let them review it. That's not an unprecedented
Act. The administration would argue that Congress will eventually have a say in terms of lifting sanctions. Also, there have been studies done and showing that over 90% of the international agreements the United States has entered into since 1939 have been done through executive action including some very important documents, such as the Shanghai Communique, the Helsinki Final Act. All of these were done through executive action.
That's
alone.
Right. But the politics, you know, the law is one thing. Clearly, can President Obama do this legally without Congress's say-so? Absolutely. Is it a stronger deal with a better chance of surviving a change of president or, political ructions here? Is it a stronger deal if Congress has had a say? Absolutely. Is Congress stronger when both parties are asking to have a say? Absolutely. And I think that's the reason that Senator Corker, the chairman of the committee, didn't sign this letter, because he wanted to go down the route of getting Democrats. And there are plenty of Democrats in the Senate who are very anxious about this deal. But now, as you say, it's become a Republican attack on the president.
Right.
Very hard for Democrats to get involved.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. Joining me today are Abdurrahim Fukar of Al Jazeera and David Rennie of The Economist. And now, this program announcement.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Abdurrahim, we're talking about the letter signed by 47 Republican senators, an open letter to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and the impact that it's had. I attended a news conference with the German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and asked him about the impact on the talks that have been going on with Iran, and he said it would undermine Western credibility and that it would give Iran more leverage in the negotiations. Do you think this letter will ultimately have that impact on the talks, or are the talks by now somehow insulated from the shenanigans in Washington?
I think they are and they are not. It's been obvious all along that President Obama has been worried about what message the Iranians would get even before the last congressional election if both houses are dominated by the Republicans. And we saw him go out of his way over the deal with Cuba. I think part of the reason why he came out so strongly in favor of the deal with Cuba was to reassure some of the adversaries outside the United States that although Congress is now dominated, both houses are dominated by the Republicans, the Iranians, for example, should not get the wrong message. He will be able to see a deal with them through. But having said that, when you look at the reaction of the Iranians, first of all, you had Khamenei himself basically trashing the letter of the Republican senators.
He said we couldn't be trusted, but he said that before, of course.
He said that before. But what I found most interesting, more interesting than Khamenei's reaction, was the reaction of the foreign minister of Iran.
Javad Zarif, yeah.
Basically lecturing Republicans about the vagaries of the American system, political system, but also reminding them that this is not just a deal with the U.S. and Iran. This involves also other partners, Western powers, who are allies of the United States in over this issue of Iran's nuclear program.
Yeah, I think the concern, if talks do not result in an agreement, there will be a blame game, David, and the Iranians will be able to point to these activities by the U.S. Congress and say, well, it's not our fault. It's because we have severe doubts about whether the United States will be able to implement an agreement because of Congress. So the question is, do you want to hand that kind of argument to the Iranians?
No, absolutely. But of course, what you're dealing with is this sort of nihilist position on the Republican side that whatever Iran says is irrelevant, and probably for a lot of them, a kind of unilateralist feeling that there is no value to an international coalition with Russians and Chinese and Europeans in it. How can you have faith in that? That that itself is nothing worth having. That the only way that this will end is with America and Israel coercing Iran to give up its bomb at the kind of the point of a threat so severe.
Yeah, of course, how do you coerce without sanctions that are multilateral?
But I think if you look at the text of the letter, which was a remarkably kind of rude letter, it sort of begins, you know, it has come to our attention, or we have reason to believe that you don't understand our constitutional system while we're observing the nuclear negotiations that you are holding with our government,
right,
completely ignoring the existence of the other countries. Because I think in the Republican worldview, this is all part of a kind of narrative at the moment that President Obama is kind of Jimmy Carter, but kind of worse, that this is a weak and feckless president who is not only a naive negotiator, but is also doesn't love America enough and doesn't believe in American exceptionalism, and therefore is willing to sell America short and to suck up to America's enemies and to leave America's allies in the ditch. And that is this incredibly powerful narrative on the Republican side, that this is an illegitimate foreign policy president.
Right. Well, we will soon see, Abdurrahim, whether these talks will come to fruition. But I want to turn now to another issue that also actually involves both the United States and Iran, and that's the fighting that's been going on in Tikrit. It looks like Iraqi forces are succeeding, but apparently two-thirds of the forces that are expelling the Islamic State from Tikrit are Shia militias, who, as we know, have been strongly backed by Iran, as is the Baghdad government. And the United States is not, as far as we know, involved in this, what could be a warm-up for going into Mosul.
Well, evidently with adversity comes also opportunity. I mean, this whole situation with ISIL, ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq, what it's done to Iraq and the Iraqis has played in Iran's favor, not just in terms of actually consolidating its influence in Iraq, but in terms of being perceived as being on the same side of the fight as the great Satan, as the Iranians once called the United States. So it's an incredible turnaround of events. Whether the militias will ultimately succeed in doing the job of defeating ISIS obviously remains to be seen. You mentioned the fight around and in Tikrit. The Iraqi army says that they have achieved some progress outside of Tikrit. The fighting continues to be fierce over the heart of Tikrit. How important is Tikrit to ISIS? We saw what they did in Kobani, and the fight was fierce and prolonged. It was said at the time that the fight of Kobani was so crucial to the future of ISIS in Iraq. Now we're hearing the same thing about Tikrit, except that this time there has been significant progress, especially if you see it from the Iraqi, Iranian and the U.S. side against ISIS. There is now some visibility as to where this is all going. Whether you can, the U.S. and its allies, including Iran now and the militias, will actually get there or how long it takes them, that's obviously not a done deal yet.
Yeah. David, obviously, if Tikrit falls from the ISIS perspective, this is a blow to their pretensions of invincibility. We're already seeing that some Iraqi Sunni groups are now joining in with the government because they perhaps sense that that Tikrit will go back into government hands. How important a victory do you think this would be? And what about this kind of awkward dance that's being done by the United States and Iran, both supporting the Iraqi government against the Islamic State, but allegedly not coordinating with each other?
Well, I think from the American perspective, you've got a very odd sort of conversation going on here in Washington. You see those Americans who are paid to understand what's happening on the ground, people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the top military officer, expressing publicly, as you say, concerns that, some of the wrong people are helping in this fight. Well, I mean, that's America discovering that if you're not prepared to put your own people into the fight, you don't get to choose who does join the fight. I mean, this is the strategy, is to let locals sort out these problems. And guess what? You know, they decide who turns up. The odd thing is, if you look at the political debates, if you look at Capitol Hill and Congress, they're not even grappling with this. You know, their narrative is that there's a very bad and dangerous Iran and a very bad and dangerous Islamic State. And there's very little acknowledgement that actually at the moment they're fighting each other. The real story is about how President Obama is such a bad president that he's incapable of defeating ISIS, and he's incapable of stopping Iran getting a bomb. And this is because he's unwilling. I mean, we're playing sort of linguistic games here. You know, people spend their entire time, if you listen to Republican politicians who want to be the next president, their main thing they say about Islamic State at the moment, and I've spent days and days listening to them recently, is the problem is that President Obama is not willing to say that they're Muslims. And until he's willing to be brave enough to say that they are Islamic, then we're never going to defeat them. So we are in such a kind of navel-gazing, kind of word game, kind of argument about rhetoric, as if somehow the power of words sort of magically will make this problem go away. There is no grown-up debate here about whether America is on the spot as Iran helps the Iraqi government take to grip. There should be that debate. As you say, you can see people at the top of the Pentagon having qualms about this. But in terms of the politics of this, there's no debate.
Yeah. Can I add this?
Sure, if you can just wait one moment.
I think in the perception of public opinion, a war that does not involve ground troops is almost an amorphous war. For Americans, because the United States does not allegedly have boots on the ground in Iraq, following this war is really a tricky issue. Yes, you hear about it all the time and you hear about ISIS and so on, but it's hard to actually grapple with and fathom. ISIS becomes something much more tangible when both Republicans and Democrats talk about ISIS, the threat of ISIS here in the United States in terms of ISIS being able to recruit within U.S. society.
Mm-hmm. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. Joining me today are David Rennie of The Economist and Abdurrahim Fukar of Al Jazeera. And now this.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Welcome back. Let's turn quickly, David, to the Israeli elections, which are coming up. These could be really momentous elections if Benjamin Netanyahu does not get enough votes, if Likud does not get enough votes to form a new government.
All Israeli elections are momentous. It's the democracy in the region. It's a big player. But these ones have unusual international sort of significance because we had, apart from anything else, we had one of the big election rallies effectively of this election took place in the U.S. House of Representatives because Benjamin Netanyahu came to give a speech at the Republicans' invitation, which was essentially an Israeli campaign rally in which he was saying, I will take on this bad American president and, you know, tell him what to do in Washington. That was a bet by Benjamin Netanyahu that in order to rally the right-wing vote in Israel, it was in his interests to pick a public fight with the American president. We haven't seen that in the past. It was always previously dangerous to fall out too much with an American president. What's interesting, if you believe, I was just looking at the reporting from our correspondents in Israel writing about the election, it doesn't seem to have really hurt him. If he is falling behind in some polls now and there's a surge from the center-left coalition, that's often about economic issues, a sense that he's talking so much about Iran and nukes and issues of war that he's forgotten that people are struggling to make their mortgage payments. They're worried about jobs. And so there doesn't seem to be a big backlash in Israel for his sort of international, certainly his assault on President Obama doesn't seem to have hurt him in Israeli politics.
Abdurim, I'm not so sure. I mean, he expected a bump from the address to the joint session of Congress, and he certainly hasn't gotten that. The polls have shown, in fact, that Likud is losing support. But there's another interesting story which is emerging. According to the polls, the center-left coalition is first and followed by Likud. But in the third spot is a joint list of Arab parties. Mm-hmm. All the various Arab parties have now joined together. And I don't think we've ever seen this before in Israel. What would it imply if the Arab list gets 14 or 15 seats in the Knesset?
Well, indeed, this is unprecedented. Although Arab Israelis are just as divided as the rest of Israelis in this particular election. But you're right, this whole debate about a united front among Arab Israelis to represent the 1.5 million Palestinians living in Israel is something new. But, you know, conventional wisdom is that the more unified you are, the more consolidated your position is within the Knesset. That's a conventional wisdom. It doesn't always work out like that in practice.
Could this, I mean, if center-left forms the government, this Arab group could actually wind up supporting it and giving it cover to make some changes in Israeli policy, perhaps on settlements, on the peace process, and that could be quite something. But we are quickly running out of time, and David, I wanted to give you a moment to talk about Hillary Clinton and her press conference. I was reminded of the comment that Barack Obama made during the 2008 campaign where he said she was likable enough. Was she likable enough? Was she persuadable enough? Do you think this issue of her emails is going to go away? Is it going to stay with us?
I don't think she's making new friends with this. I think there are quite a lot of Democrats who understand they don't have any alternative candidate of any stature at all. And so they're either saying this is just a Republican beat up and we're going to sort of circle the wagons and defend her, or they're just going, oh my goodness, she's at it again. The Clintons are just very secretive, very high-handed people who think they're above the rules, but we haven't got a choice, so we're going to stick with her. But she didn't make any new friends or new admirers this week, and they have a problem, which is that she isn't a fantastic candidate. The idea of Hillary Clinton is often more exciting than the reality of Hillary Clinton.
Abdurim, there was a column by a Washington Post columnist, Charles Krautheimer, that was talking about early Clinton fatigue syndrome. Are we already getting tired of her and she hasn't yet declared?
Well, Charles Krauthammer is the kind of thing that you would expect him to say, being who he is. Look, the Clintons, as we all know, they are capable of incredible comebacks. And we've seen this from Bill, we've seen it from Hillary. And I wouldn't put it past her to leap back again to the forefront, although this business of the emails has at least temporarily hurt her.
All right. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
from Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.